Session number 10776, reel 4.
Dr. Pat Rawlins, reel 4. Were there any other, peculiarities in the Chinese situation which impressed you?
Although officially foot binding had been illegal, I think actually since the 1911 days of Sun Yat-sen, certainly since Chiang Kai-shek's day in the 20s and 30s, it had been made illegal, but we still had a lot of elderly ladies there who'd had bound feet, perhaps before they were actually made illegal, and the practice was still to some extent carried out in spite of the ruling about it. And we did see some quite young girls with bound feet. What struck me in particular was that it wasn't just the feet that had been bound. The whole of the lower leg was thin and wasted, and the foot was sort of curled up into a claw like this, and so they walked on the stumps of their toes, on the dorsal surface of their toes, really, and these funny little sort of thing. But what we did find, of course, was that the blood supply to the lower part of the leg was very much impaired, so they were particularly prone to ulcers. I mean, any little insect bite or anything like that would go septic and form ulcers and so on. And if they fell, they were liable to break this very weak tibia, which presumably that had also been affected by the binding. So we did get fractures of people with bound feet, or bound legs, I suppose, really, would be more accurate to call them. But there again, it was just the accepted thing. And down there in Mohe, there was far more of it than you saw in Kunming, for instance. Just like everything, which was absolutely archaic.
It seems to be, from what you say, a relatively cut-off area. I was wondering about the war situation, whether that had impinged on that area at all.
Not at all. I would say there was no sign of it. I think they seemed to know about it, but they didn't seem to be afraid that the Japanese were going to invade there. We did, but and there was just no no sign of a war being on. In fact, there wasn't in Kunming either. And the first thing, just jumping ahead a bit now when we got back, was to find that the American convoys had started coming through the Burma Road. And that was the first, of course, apart from Chinese military in the part of Western China that was still, that they still occupied, there were plenty of Chinese troops and military about. But there was nothing. Down in Mohe, there were soldiers, whether they were private militia belonging to Yuan Jiang and his lot, other people like that, or whether they were Chiang Kai-shek Kuomintang troops, I wouldn't know. I don't think.
What sort of state were they in, these soldiers? Can you remember?
Yes, very bad. They had this grey padded uniform, always in tatters. They looked very demoralised, very dejected. They of course marched on sawhai as well, straw sandals, and had sort of fairly heavy packs to carry. I don't remember much about their armaments. I think most of them were unarmed, actually. But there wasn't much evidence of rifles or machine guns or anything about the place.
Would you say that you had sort of freedom of movement during the 2 years that you were in this area?
Yes.
You were allowed to come and go without reference to Jiang?
Oh, yes, indeed. Although, of course, movement was restricted by virtue of the fact that you could only get anywhere on foot or by horseback. You see. So I think, actually, if you had wanted to be taken anywhere, because you could have a litter. In fact, that was the way the bigwigs travelled. They had two chaps with a shoulder chair thing. And you probably wouldn't have been able to get a litter to take you anywhere without Jiang knowing. Maybe it would have been restricted in that sense. I've just thought of one. You asked about any sign of war there. There was one amazing occasion when, of course, what's now Vietnam was our southern border down that way, and our track went on down to we then called French Indochina. And there was a coup by the Japanese down there. I gathered that the Japanese, of course, had occupied Indochina, and I think the French and Japanese sort of had a kind of coalition down there. I think it was a sort of Vichy French type of thing. But at some stage of some sort of coup, and the remaining the French troops escaped from Indochina and came up our track, you see, and arrived at Mohe with about 50 huge, great cavalry horses. The likes of which the Chinese had never seen before. Their horses were all ponies about this high, and these great sort of 17-hand cavalry horses there with French-speaking troops, you see. It fell to my lot to be interpreter between French and Chinese. They were billeted. They found the billets for them. They were all very weary. And they stayed about a week in Mohe before ultimately going off to Kunming. And I don't know how many actually got through, but of course these big horses were nothing like as agile on the mountain tracks as the little Chinese ponies and mules. But they'd managed to get that far, so I presume a lot of them must have got through. But that was the only actual sign of a war that I remember actually seeing. We saw no aircraft above or anything.
I was wondering also, you know, your communications with home. Did you get letters from your family?
Oh, yes, but they took such an age. I mean, I suppose it was about 3 months to get a letter from home and vice versa. I certainly got one very sad letter which told me my brother had been killed in shortly after D-Day in Normandy, and that was in 1945, so yes, we were still then in Mohe then. It must have been towards the end of our time in Mohe.
Yes, I didn't ask you about your siblings, you know, whether anyone went into the war.
My brother was called up. He went into horse guards, which of course there were no horses, but he was killed in a Daimler scout car out ahead of the doing of reconnaissance work, hit by a tank gun, I think. And my sister trained as a physiotherapist at St. Thomas's, and she went out with the Army Medical Corps. I think there was a physiotherapy corps. She went to finish up in Algiers.
What would you say was the impact of your little FAU unit in Mohe during the 2 years?
Well, absolutely staggering, I should think. the people took to us, as you can imagine they would, with their total absence of any medical facilities. And here were we coming, offering them what were then the latest things, and actually curing them of many seemingly incurable diseases. I mean, they'd never seen or heard anything like this before. And, of course, it was planned that we would hand over to a Chinese team that the Wei Sin Shu were supposed to supply. But, of course, in the end, there was nothing forthcoming, and much to our regret, we had to pull out and leave nobody in charge there. So I don't really know what happened after that.
You had no feedback from this young girl who was...
No, that was the sad thing. We left Barbara there and never heard anything more of her until, as I said... Yeah. Do you... Well, until, amazingly enough, in April of this year, 1989... a letter from Taiwan came out of the blue from Barbara herself, and she's telling me that she'd been married just after our time, after we left, to a Chinese, of course that would be a Kuomintang army officer, and they had moved, as she put it, to Taiwan when the 1949, when the Mao regime took charge. Moved. I imagine they fled rather than just moved, but at least she was safe, and I've been so relieved after that to realise that there she is. She says she's had 5 children, 10 grandchildren. Her husband had died, though, sadly, 10 years or so ago.
did the Jiang, you know, the leader, yeah, in that area, did he give you any sort of send-off?
Oh, yes. We had a tremendous feasting, and then I think half the place turned out and marched along with us as far as the bridge over the river close by, about a mile or two out of the town, and then we took a sad farewell. Of course, we were then not going back. We were going further on, because We the way we came out of Mohe was very different to how we came in, having marched over the mountains for 2 weeks. We did 2 more days southwards to get to Samao, which was the place we were originally supposed to go to, you see, which we never reached in the first place. And at Samao, by the time during the time we were in Mohe, the Americans had built an airstrip down there. And the problem was that when we got to Samao, the airstrip was more or less underwater. And every day one of these DC-3s would come down and make a few low passes and then fly away again. And this went on for about a week. And it hadn't actually rained for about 3 or 4 days. It was right in the middle of the rainy season. And this chap came in again and did more than the usual 3 or 4 passes and kept on coming. We thought, and then suddenly we saw him put his undercarriage down and talk about coming in on a wing and a prayer. Oh, gosh, it was hairy. As he landed, the water came sort of shooting up under him. And when he reached the end of the grass runway, he came to a halt, and his wheels disappeared up to the axles in the ground. And it took about 5 water buffalo and about 100 men to pull it out. Then, of course, he had to examine all the... He got him back to the little bit of concrete where the hangars were, and he had to check up to see that everything was all right. In fact, actually, I don't think they had to do anything to the undercarriage. It had survived this. And the next day, Billy Toop had joined us by then. Billy Toop, Dave Johnson, myself, David Yu, and Jane Wong, and Mrs. Park, the American lady missionary who'd been down there all the time with us. And we all boarded this old Dakota. Well, it was a new Dakota by in those days, or DC-3, I should call it, and took off, sort of started taking off, and, you know, there was still a tremendous water logging of all this grass track, and you could hear the water coming, hitting the wings underneath like this, and the old thing staggered along, and, you know, we wondered whether he was going to make it, and finally, just about at the end of the grass strip, he pulled it back, and just once we were away from the ground, we knew we were all right. And then we were back in Kunming in 2 hours, having taken 2 weeks to get there.
Did you have any worry at any time that you might not be allowed to leave?
I think by that time, mind you, it hadn't dawned upon me that we had not been allowed to leave in the first place. I just thought it was a change of plan and that we'd stopped at Moab. It wasn't until years afterwards that I began to wonder whether we had in fact been subjected to a little bit of arm twisting. I'm still not sure, actually. I suspect that this was the case, but until I've seen Jane Wong again and quizzed her about this, I'm not really quite sure it's. I've probably been a bit naive about it, really, but then I've been a bit naive all my life.
Then I think you went to the leper hospital for a while, didn't you?
Yes, well, now we'll go on from Mohe. There's a lot more I could tell you about that time down there, but roughly where it was. But are you taping now? Well, then we come out of Mohe into Kunming, and I stayed for a little while in Kunming, and then, as we'd been so isolated and hadn't met the rest of the FAU, they sent me and Dave Johnson and Jane Wong, the three of us, we went into Chungking. We flew from Kunming to Chungking. That was a marvellous experience because in those days you landed on when the Yangtze wasn't in flood, actually. You landed down on the sand in the basin of the river there, and you came in with the sides of the river sort of towering above you there like this, all the little huts and shanty places up on the cliffs, and you came in down there. Of course, the first thing you met was all the sewage of Chungking down there. And incidentally, another very interesting thing was that, of course, the Americans were sending gold into into China, and we had quite a large number of gold ingots on board this plane coming in from Kunming to Chungking. And these were unloaded in the open, just gold bars put onto the tiao poles, and towed up the steps all the way through Chungking, just like that, to the bank in China. I think it was the most amazing thing there. And anyway, then I attended the FAU it was a sort of AGM, but they had a different name for it, but I can't quite remember what it was, actually. But it was just, you know, we had to report on it. And incidentally, I'd sent a report in each month from Mohe, which was fairly sort of worked out statistically, you know, on exactly what we'd done. And which of course formed the basis of that thesis I wrote up there. And so we had a very nice time there, very relaxed, meeting all the FAU bigwigs. Then they suggested that we, that Dave Johnston, myself and Jane, would like to go to this leper station, which hadn't had a doctor for a number of years. And of course, I'd never actually seen any leprosy, but I'd just learnt a bit about it at our before we came out. And so they provided us with... incidentally, this was somewhere up on the Chengdu Road. I can't remember the name of the place, actually, but it was several days' run up the... similar to the Burma Road, you know, very, very mountainous road there from Chongqing to Chengdu. And I think it was a good 3 or 4 days' run. And they provided us with a very dilapidated old Ford V8 pickup truck. And this particular leper hospital or home or whatever they called it was being run by German Protestant missionaries who wore a grey kind of Quaker kind of uniform. And one of them was there with us in Chongqing, who was, I think she was returning from leave or somehow. And anyway, we were asked to take her with us. So we were the four of us, David, myself and Jane, and this German lady, whose name I forget, Sister something or other, anyway, we called her. And we set off in this thing, David and I doing alternate two-hour stretches of driving. And I think on about the second or third day, I took over just at the top of one of these enormous 24 hairpin bend gorges and discovered as we reached the top that the brakes had gone. You see, they'd been okay when I'd been driving, and they gradually were just these Bendix sort of cable-operated brakes which stretched and stretched. And there was this awful hairy moment when I approached this hairpin bend at the top and realised that I wasn't going to make it. Absolutely by the grace of God, I suppose, there was a ditch, a fence and a high bank straight ahead. So I just drove straight into all this lot. We went backwards down into the ditch. And I don't know whether the German lady understood what had happened, that I'd done this on purpose rather than risk going wrong. I'm sure we'd have gone straight over if I'd tried to take that first bend. And anyway, as luck would have it, a Chinese army lorry came along a little bit later and pulled us out backwards. And we then continued the journey without any brakes, but knowing that what to do, we just got into bottom gear whenever we went to go downhill. And of course, that big V8 engine acted as a very good brake, but we had nothing to use with our feet at all to stop with. So anyway, we ultimately arrived at this leper hospital. And another sort of amazing piece of seemingly divine intervention or something. The old, very elderly mother superior, they called them all these sort of Roman Catholic kind of names, but they were very Protestant in their whole thing there. The old lady, the mother superior of the place, had died the day before. She was in her 90s. And nobody seemed to know what to do, you know. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, a doctor and a nurse arrived just like that. And I had to just sort of see the old dear and certify that she really was dead. And then Jane took over and did all the last rites and everything, you know. And it was really very moving because, you know, they seemed to, they'd all been praying to what to do. And we turn up, you see. So anyway, we spent, I think, about a fortnight there, and there were about 200 people in there, some of whom were quite young In very early stages, they were all just having injections of Chaulmoogra oil. Some, of course, were terribly mutilated and severe. But there was a lovely atmosphere there, which the German missionaries had imbued there. And then we went back to Kunming, to Chongqing. And, well, then I was told that I was to go home. It wasn't really, my time wasn't up, but I had actually been pretty ill in Mohair. I haven't mentioned that. But,
yes, I was going to ask you. I think you had...
Well, I got relapsing fever myself out there, and the trouble was... Do you want me to go back over that little bit of it? Because that was really how we came to have to leave in the end, because there was a terrible disease that was spreading along there were these tracks that the mountain people used to come into the markets, the tribespeople or the ethnic minorities, as we would now call them. We called them tribespeople then, but they were lovely people, quite different from the Chinese, of course. And they did their own trades up in the mountains, making lovely things, embroideries and things like that. Also, they grew sweet corn, which was mainly their diet, and they came brought that down. And they brought these things into the market in Mohe, and from all surrounding districts. And so any disease that seemed to be generated out there was gradually, you could see it, following these mountain tracks, you see. And there were villages just being decimated by some disease which was thought to be malaria. And so they asked us to go out to one of these villages that was then about a day's journey away from Mohe. And so we went out there with our lab equipment, and of course discovered that it wasn't malaria, it was relapsing fever that was killing these people, you see. And so we went there several days running with our supplies of this arsenic, juice, you see. We must have had a good stock of it, because we did a tremendous lot of injections of it. And we were there long enough to see some of the early cases that we injected picking up and recovering. You see, some cases had gone too far and they died. And I remember, actually, on one occasion, I was giving one of these injections, as I took the needle back and it still had some of the patient's blood in it, I just sort of nicked the edge of my thumb like that, you see. I never gave it another thought. And then we were starting to leave Mohe when I got ill, you see, and we were 3 days out of Mohe on our road back, and we had to get back to the hospital. In fact, I was too bad to ride on my pony. In fact, I did ride some of the way, and I got my leg sort of caught on the straps of the thing and got a horrible great carbuncle there. And when I got back to Mohe, I was extremely ill. And, of course, I'd forgotten about this little nick in my thumb there, and had been taking large doses of mepocrine, which is liable to send you round the bend anyway, even if it's for the right purpose. But then, of course, Dave Johnson did a quick blood film, it was swarming with spirochetes, you see. So then Billy Toop had then come down. Of course, I'd previously complained of tummy pains, and he'd come down sort of was helping me out then. He'd been sent down officially to take my appendix out. So I had this shot of 914 juice, and after about 3 days of complete delirium, I suddenly sort of started to get better.